Good morning. I'm Dr. Verdi, and you are tuning into Seeking Wellness Radio, Our Bodies Explained on WPKN 89.5 FM. The information in this broadcast is intended to help you feel inspired and informed in making proactive lifestyle decisions to improve your health, the health of your loved ones, and your local community through inspiring and educating. This is normally a call-in show, but today's show was pre-recorded. I found over time that there's a couple of perspectives on what defines good health in our society. One school of thought sees health as the absence of any detectable diseases or symptoms. This type of health assessment occurs during the annual exam. When people go to their primary, they'll get a physical exam, get labs run, and answer questions that their doctors strategically ask them to assess their state of health. And at the end of the appointment, or maybe a week or two later, once the labs are in, patients will find out whether or not they have any medical issues, what their cholesterol levels look like, if they need to modify their diet or lifestyle. So that type of healthcare is focused more on detecting diseases and providing treatments for them. But there's another approach to health which assesses a person's vitality. What does vitality mean? Well, I had one professor who taught acupuncture at my medical program who attempted to define vitality to us by assigning us to go to the market and look a dead fish in the eye. A dead fish eye, he said, is the absence of vitality. He explained that you could often assess a person's vitality by looking in their eyes and looking to see if there's a spark. And many of you probably do this unknowingly when you say hello to a friend and ask how they're doing. You almost always look at their face, look them in the eyes, and see how they respond. And sometimes their answer will be right in their eyes. So even when they say, "I'm good," you'll be able to tell in their eyes that there's something bothering them. Or say a patient lost their, or a person, your friend has lost their voice, but they respond with excitement in their eyes. So the eyes can give a lot of information about how somebody's state of health is. You may see that they're excited about something new. They may be anticipating good news in their life, or you may see that they're disappointed, or they may be struggling with a problem in their life, which you'll also see in their eyes. To me, the antithesis to dead fish eye is the eyes of a young child, which is often so full of life and curiosity. And that life and curiosity is exactly what vitality refers to. The state of being strong, active, and energetic. The power-giving continuance of life that's present in all things. So when people are vital, they are in active engagement with life. And right now, it seems as if a lot of people talk about biological age versus chronological age. So chronological age is the number of years that you've been alive here on Earth. And biological age refers to the age of your cells. And there's plenty of lab tests that look at things such as the length of your telomeres to determine what your biological age is. The telomeres are a part of our DNA. They're the tail end of our DNA. And every time our cells replicate, the DNA shortens a little bit in the segment of the telomere. And as telomeres shorten, cells get older. So telomere length is a reflection of biological age. Telomeres can actually, they can elongate once they've been shortened. So your biological age can change. And there have been instances where people's telomeres have been measured to be short. And as they add in a high antioxidant, anti-inflammatory diet as part of their healthcare routine, their telomeres have been found to be longer. So antioxidant status is also used to look at biological age. But to me, the true reflection of one's biological age is reflected in their vitality. We've all met that 80-year-old lifetime cigar smoker and whiskey drinker that managed to dodge heart disease, cancer, and other causes of premature death. And we've wondered, why are they so healthy in spite of eating a poor diet and drinking and smoking all the time? Or we've met that hardy 94-year-old woman who survived heart disease, heart attacks, breast cancer, and managed to die of old age. And we ask ourselves again, what was it about this 94-year-old that caused her to be so resilient in the face of disease? And I believe that the vitality of these individuals was a big reason why they've managed to live so long and live such healthy lives. At the same time, I've met 17-year-olds going on 70 who are exhausted and sick and tired and have such little vitality when I look them in the eyes and talk with them. So I look for many more signs of vitality outside of just looking in the eyes of my patients when I say hi to them. I also look at whether they have a spark for life, interests and ideas, or concepts that they're passionate about. Sometimes, when you feel like your doctor's making small talk with you, they're actually assessing many different parts of your health outside of just your physiological body. When patients excitedly tell me about their plans for vacation that's coming up or excitement about their half marathon that they're training for, I know that they're engaged with life. They're still learning and they're curious and in awe of the world. But everyone can get stuck in a rut, even the most vital people. And these are the things that you can gather from someone to determine their vitality. Do they seem like they're actively engaged in their life? Do they seem inspired by the world around them? So the vitalist approach to medicine is an approach to healthcare that's been practiced for thousands of years in virtually every culture. And this approach looks for the absence of disease along with the presence of this vitality that I'm speaking about. When someone is experiencing vitality, they are physically and emotionally balanced and spiritually connected. When I refer to being spiritually connected, I'm not meaning in a religious way. They're connected with their life purpose. They're connected with their friends and their family, and they're inspired and intentional with their life and have fulfilling relationships. So you're probably wondering at this point, where is Dr. Verdi going with all of this vitalist nonsense? Well, I'm taking us to a place that many of us were a mere 48 hours ago. We're going to go back to Thanksgiving, back to gratitude, and back to giving thanks. So for those of you who are just tuning in, this is Dr. Verdi from Seeking Wellness Radio. And this is a monthly radio show that broadcasts on the fourth Saturday of every month from 9 to 10 a.m. This is usually a call-in show, but this show was pre-recorded. And the show is all about the health benefits of gratitude and how developing a gratitude practice can change your health. It turns out that one measure of vitality is how easily and often someone taps into feelings of gratitude about their life. And this gratitude is felt even as people are enduring the most difficult times of their life. So vital people, even when their glass is half full and they're struggling with things like their health or financial burden, it's found that they tend to see the positive the silver lining in whatever they're going through. So gratitude is not a practice that people are born with. It's one that's cultivated over time. Similar to how practicing planks, for example, every day, although challenging, improves our entire musculoskeletal system and strengthens our body over time. So a gratitude practice is one that people have to really work at and be intentional about developing. And in general, what I've found is that experiencing better health starts and is sustained with an intentional and positive mindset. At the heart of our holiday season, when you set aside all of the commercial influences of the newest seasonal coffee at your local coffee place, or all of the Christmas gifts and holiday parties that are coming up, regardless of whether you even have a religious practice or not, at the heart of the holiday season is gratitude. Giving thanks and showing appreciation to the people in our lives and for ourselves. And we'll talk soon about how gratitude provides innumerable benefits to our health. So I know that I might sound a little cheesy to some of you, and you may be feeling resistance to this message of experiencing gratitude. And if you are, ask yourself why. It's very likely that there's a meaningful reason why you may have developed resistance to the practice of gratitude. Is it that you feel that perhaps you're too often taken for granted, that you do so much for others and very rarely do you get a thank you? Or is it that maybe good things aren't happening in your life? Or maybe you just think that you don't deserve good things because there are so many people out there right now where life is going wrong for them. Whatever your hesitation is, I urge you to keep listening, because research is also finding that grateful people are pleasant for others to be around. They make others feel good simply through their attitude of gratitude. So, what is gratitude? Well, to put it simply, it's a cognitive state that most commonly occurs when one person notes that they've received something of value from another person. And this item of value, it could be a favor, it could be a gift, it could be advice, it could come in so many different forms. But the most common theme is that the recipient was not expecting the favor. They weren't anticipating somebody would do something nice for them. And we'll talk soon about how you can cultivate a gratitude practice outside of the typical giving and receiving framework that we engage in during the holiday season. So, grateful people, it's been found that they experience better mental health, they feel happier, and they have more life satisfaction. So they feel more content with their lives at any given moment. Which makes sense if somebody's constantly viewing their life in a positive perspective, that they would feel happy and fulfilled. And when comparing personality traits, so different positive personality traits such as optimism and hope and compassion, gratitude was ranked as the number one personality trait that would predict life satisfaction and influence the overall mood of somebody. So out of all of those personality traits, gratitude seemed to be the most effective. Grateful people also tend to feel predominantly positive feelings, including love and optimism. And they don't feel negative emotions such as envy, resentment, greed, or bitterness. And the last show, when we talked about, I think it might have been two shows ago, we were talking about social media and the effect that social media can have on people. And we found that a lot of people experience depressive feelings after being on social media, and it's related to feeling envious or unsatisfied with their life. Well, it turns out that having that gratitude practice will help you feel happier for people when their lives are going well. And it turns out that people don't end up comparing themselves and where they're at in their lives with other people. Grateful people also tend to be perceived as helpful, outgoing, and optimistic, and tend to be more trusted than ungrateful people. Positive self-esteem is also something that increases with a gratitude practice, and this was noted in the Journal of Applied Sports Psychology in 2014. They found that these athletes stopped comparing themselves with the athletic performance of other athletes and felt happier with themselves. And self-esteem is essential to how well athletes and people in general perform in different tasks. So the fascinating thing about all of these findings is that virtually anybody can become a grateful person. It's a personality trait that can be developed over time. And it's few and far between where you'll meet a grateful person who didn't need to actively work on cultivating gratitude. War veterans are one of the most traumatized groups of people. And a study in behavioral research and therapy found that Vietnam War vets with higher levels of gratitude in their lives had lower rates of PTSD. Another study in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology found that gratitude was a major contributor to how quickly people bounced back after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. So gratitude can actually protect us from developing post-traumatic stress disorder after experiencing some sort of trauma or loss in our lives. It's almost like it develops our emotional immunity. And your body on gratitude changes. So when you say thank you, for example, even if you don't mean it, your brain perceives that you are appreciating something and will send signals to the rest of your body, which causes endorphins to become released. And endorphins are those very strong, positive, feel-good neurotransmitters. And so taking it a step further, when people say thank you with intention, this endorphin effect is enhanced significantly. So if you're just tuning in, this is Dr. Verdee from Seeking Wellness Radio on WPKN 89.5 FM. And you're tuning into a radio episode today that's all about gratitude and the health benefits of cultivating a gratitude practice. It turns out that developing a gratitude practice may be the single best thing that you could do for your health. And it's especially important during this holiday season where it's the season of gratitude. So physically, grateful people have been found to have less aches and pains in their body. And part of me wonders, could this be because there's this consistent release of endorphins in the body? Could there be other neurotransmitter changes that haven't been studied yet? Or could it be that our mindset can affect how we perceive pain? Could sad people be much more sensitive to pain, whereas grateful people are less sensitive to pain signals? It's unclear why this is the case, but consistently when people have been told to cultivate a gratitude practice and then given questionnaires, they were found to report less aches and pains compared to groups of people who were given questionnaires without being told to cultivate a gratitude practice. Grateful people have also been found to be more proactive about their health. They're more likely to exercise regularly and eat well. More importantly, they sleep better. A 2011 study published in Applied Psychology found that spending just 15 minutes writing a few grateful notes about your day before bed helps people sleep better and longer. So what you think about before bed can really impact your sleep. And I'm sure there's been a couple of you listeners out there that have read, for example, a Stephen King book before bed and found that you had the most imaginative and intense dreams that night. And a lot of people find that when they meditate before bed, they have calm and peaceful sleep. Well, imagine having a gratitude practice before bed, and when you do wake up at night, you're thinking positive thoughts about your life. In an article published by the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence, it was found that gratitude can lower blood pressure, improve our immune function, which we could all use during the holiday season. And gratitude practices reduces the lifetime risk for depression and anxiety and substance abuse disorders. So these mental and emotional changes from gratitude occur on an emotional level, even on a spiritual level, in terms of helping us to feel more vital and connected within our lives. But then also it looks like on a physiological level, with the lowering of blood pressure, the better sleep, the better immune function, less aches and pains. Gratitude seems to penetrate through our entire body and through our lives. Having a gratitude practice seems to also make the people around us happier. So when you experience gratitude on a regular basis, one thing that you may notice is that you'll start to remember and recall happier experiences in your life. And you'll also solidify happy experiences in your mind. And this is because just on a day-to-day basis, you're more aware of when good things are happening in your life, or you're more aware of when you feel grateful feelings. And then you can tap into what it is about those circumstances, situations, that made you so happy and grateful, and have more of that in your life. So, how to experience gratitude? We aren't wired to experience gratitude regularly. Our brains are wired to detect stressors, any sort of stressors in our lives. So, back in the past, it may have been the stressor of famine because there was drought, or the stressor of dealing with a lion. I'm just going to use the classic lion caveman example. So dealing with a lion, where we are aware that there's a lion in this specific area, and because our bodies are primed to detect stressors, we remember that there's a lion in that area, and so we can steer clear of danger. So our brains need to be able to remember harmful experiences or memories. It's almost protective. But in this day and age, a lot of our stressors are work-related or related to interpersonal conflict. And our brains, since they're primed to remember negative experiences, our brains tend to hold on to things like that interpersonal conflict that we're dealing with, or that life stressor that we're dealing with that we really can't impact. Another example is people who have experienced trauma early in life. Their brains actually change the brain structures themselves. So if you've experienced early trauma, it's more likely that your brain has undergone physical changes in areas such as the amygdala and the hippocampus that's related to emotional processing. So the amygdala specifically processes negative feelings and emotions, and it's found to be larger in people who have experienced trauma in their lives. And people who have experienced trauma also tend to have more pessimistic thinking and anxiety and depression throughout their lives. There's a great book written by, I believe, Daniel Goldman and the Dalai Lama called Destructive Emotions. That's all about how our brain changes in response to trauma and how those changes cause us to continuously look at bad things in our lives, look at stressors in our lives or things that make us anxious in our lives. And it turns into this vicious cycle of, you know, having a trauma and then feeling sad and then feeling sad about things in your life that you can't control and then feeling anxious because you have no control. And the book Destructive Emotions is all about how developing a mindfulness practice can help people take a step back from their routine internal dialogue and take a break from it and just see the world how it is. And it turns out that MRIs that have been done on people who experience trauma, first an MRI before intervention, they found that they had a larger amygdala and hippocampal region. And then they were told to engage in a mindfulness practice for 6 weeks. And after the 6 weeks, their amygdala and hippocampus was found to be smaller because they weren't engaging in a lot of those negative thoughts as much. So our brains can remodel themselves with some intentional changes to our lifestyle, such as meditation and gratitude journaling. There's a book called Thanks, How Practicing Gratitude Can Make You Happier. And there are stages to the gratitude practice that are described in this book. Stage one is recognizing what we're grateful for. So kind of like becoming an investigator in your life day to day and consistently asking yourself, what am I grateful for? What's grateful about this experience that I'm having right now in my life? And then step two is acknowledging it. So once you identify the things that you feel happy about, acknowledging it, thanking it. And then step three is appreciating it. And appreciating it is more of a body-wide emotion. It's almost like a physical emotion where your body is able to appreciate it and you feel all of these feel-good emotions. And some people describe it as like a buzzing in their body, a state of giddiness, while other people describe it as just feeling warm and content. Everybody experiences gratitude differently, but once you start to feel gratitude, you'll feel happier and other people will feel better. It's an infective trait to have. So gratitude journaling is one way to cultivate gratitude. And it was found that when people were asked to journal about gratitude, they started to exercise regularly and they felt more optimistic about their upcoming week compared to those who just recorded their hassles in life or just wrote about neutral life events. So this is important. This means that there is a correct way to journal. Sometimes, you know, friends or family members or even your doctor may recommend that you keep a journal. And I've known plenty of people who thought keeping a journal meant writing about everything that happened in their day from A to Z. And after a while, that can get exhausting. After maybe 7 days of writing about everything that's happened in your day, you could get tired of it and then put your journal aside and never journal again. Other people will approach journaling by writing and analyzing every bad thing that's ever happened to them. And that could be potentially a constructive approach to journaling in the sense that if people are not very connected with themselves and their life experiences, it may help them figure some things out. But for the most part, it may just leave people feeling worse after they journal. But journaling about positive things, happy experiences, seems to have all of these health benefits that we've talked about earlier in the show. So when gratitude journaling was implemented in young adults, so teenagers, they were found to have a higher state of alertness and enthusiasm, and they were more determined and had more energy, which is something that a lot of teens can use, especially with how difficult a lot of high school curriculums are these days and the demands of applying for colleges. So if you're just tuning in, I'm Dr. Verdi, and you're listening to Seeking Wellness Radio, Our Bodies Explained. And today's episode is all about how cultivating a gratitude practice may be the single best thing you could do for your health. And so far, we've talked about the mental and emotional changes, as well as the physical changes that can occur for people with practicing gratitude, ranging from lower blood pressure to better immunity to people being more pleasant to be around and perceived as more pleasant people. And that gratitude is infectious. So grateful people tend to make other people feel grateful. So all this talk about the benefits of cultivating gratitude, now we're going to go into how to cultivate gratitude. So as I've mentioned earlier, developing gratitude takes practice. It takes time. It's like a muscle that you have to consistently work at and build. There's a lot of different ways to build gratitude. 5-minute journaling is one of my favorite types of gratitude practices. And there's actually plenty of gratitude-centered apps that you can access on your phone. And they help in one way that the apps help is that you have it there on your phone. So instead of wasting time playing games or texting, you could quickly log into your gratitude app and engage in a few minutes of gratitude throughout your day. And the 5-minute journaling app, there's a lot of research on gratitude journaling, and people are often asked to write about moments of gratitude, even if they're mundane, ordinary things, because what you'll find when you start your gratitude practice is that you may start off with really big things like, I'm grateful for my life and the hot running water that I have and the roof over my head because it's really cold outside. And you'll kind of be grateful about these big things in your life. But eventually, you'll run out of big, big things to be grateful for. And you'll start to appreciate little things like your morning coffee, for example. But even personal attributes, for example, my ability to multitask could be an example of one thing that somebody could honor about themselves and their personality, or about things that you value about other people, encounters that you've had, experiences that you had that day, unexpected experiences, the sunset. There's virtually so many things in our lives that we could be grateful for. It's just a matter of training our brains to detect them. In one study on gratitude journaling, it was found that people who journaled about gratitude felt so much better about their lives compared to people who journaled about the hassles in their lives or neutral life experiences, as we talked about earlier. So there seems to be a way to journal that involves journaling about gratitude. So I think the reason why gratitude journaling works is because it slowly changes the way that we perceive situations by adjusting what we focus on. You kind of open your eyes up to the world around you, and that helps to enhance your gratitude practice. One thing you could do is make a game with your family out of gratitude and ask each other at dinner or lunch or breakfast, whatever meal you're all together for, what you're all grateful for that day. So I'm going to tangent a little bit to when I was in my residency. So when I was in residency, the hours were really, really long. And when I wasn't in clinic, I was usually charting, catching up on chart notes. So my days were long and they were exhausting. And I remember when I came home once, my father-in-law asked me, you know, what my favorite part of residency has been so far. And I couldn't think of anything. As embarrassing as it is to admit, I couldn't think of any favorite moment of my residency. And I realized then that I had unintentionally been so focused on work that the only thing that my brain could think about was work and how tired I was and how much work I had to do. And some of the more difficult cases I was working on that year involved really challenging cases and, you know, situations. So it was a pretty difficult time in clinic in terms of working with some of my patients who were going through a lot of hardships. And I was finding that it was hard for me to pull myself out of my work. And I think a lot of the listeners have had similar times in their life where they were kind of deeply embedded in a certain part of their life and not acknowledging other parts of their lives and not feeling a variety of positive emotions, kind of just focusing on work. So when my father-in-law noticed this, he said, there's a way that you can start to remember the more positive things in your life. And that had a huge impact on me because I realized that I had been so stressed and overwhelmed that I had kind of lost that ability to feel gratitude or think about positive things spur of the moment. But after becoming more aware of it and developing a gratitude practice, I was able to, you know, as soon as somebody asked me, what's your favorite part of residency, I was able to answer five different things right on the spot. So that was my big wake-up call to the fact that your brain can change based on what your life circumstances are, but at the same time, you can change your brain so that your life circumstances are perceived differently. So some people will keep a gratitude jar. And gratitude jars, you can Google it and look at images of them. People decorate them and make them beautiful. It can be a really fun activity with the kids. And throughout the year, people will write about experiences that they were really grateful for. And it can be really small things, unexpected acts of kindness from strangers. And what people will do is at the end of the year, they'll go through it with their family and remember all of those positive things that happened that year. Another way to practice gratitude is writing a gratitude letter to someone who had an impact on you that you never properly thanked. And I'm sure you can think of plenty of people who really helped you during certain times in your life, who you constantly think about and feel grateful for. Well, writing a letter can increase those feelings, those endorphins, and the feelings of gratitude. And give them the letter, and then your gratitude will become infectious because that person will feel so good after being thanked that they'll want to thank somebody. Other things that you can do is list things that you're grateful for in your partner, or your parent. You can call up your parent and just say, hey, I'm really grateful for that one experience I had with you or that one personal trait that you have that you gave to me that I inherited from you, or grateful things about your child. It might even be a fun thing to do with family this Thanksgiving weekend. So I challenge you to start to cultivate a gratitude practice. Do it together with your family or with some of your friends. Keep each other accountable. It would be a great New Year's resolution, actually, to start to be more grateful. And it would be one that, as we've talked about earlier, will spread into other parts of your life, including your health and the health of your relationships. Last show, I didn't have a chance to go into some herbs that can boost your immune system during the winter months. And because we have a couple of minutes left, I thought that I would talk about them. So one of them is elderberry syrup. It's actually, whenever autumn is upon us, I make sure to keep a bottle of elderberry syrup in my fridge. It has a kind of sweet, kind of tart flavor. And sometimes I'll recommend that people, if they're used to drinking juices and sodas, or if they need to cut back on alcohol, I'll recommend that they pour a spoonful of elderberry syrup into water. It's really fun to put it into a wine glass and kind of sip on it and make it a leisurely activity. Kids also love elderberry syrup. So sometimes I'll recommend that parents give their children elderberry syrup instead of juice, since there's a lot of research pointing to juice as one of the causes for obesity and diabetes in children. My husband is often in the midst of the latest bacterial or viral infection because he works in the emergency setting. So I often use elderberry to strengthen his immune system, my own immune system, and now the immune system of my 9-month-old baby. Elderberry is really high in zinc, and zinc has been found to increase the activity of our white blood cells, which are the cells that detect and kill bacteria and viruses. Elderberry is also very high in flavonoids, which are antioxidants that give elderberry that beautiful purple-blue color. And the antioxidants have antiviral and anti-inflammatory effects. And when we're sick, it's interesting to note that we have more inflammation in our body. That's not because of the bacteria or virus. It's because of our immune response. So, for example, we have white blood cells called macrophages, and their job is to literally eat anything that looks like it can be foreign or tissues that have been damaged. And when that happens, there's a lot of free radicals that are created from the enzymes that the macrophages use to digest our tissues and bacteria and viruses. And so, for example, when people have a cold and a sore throat, the pain in their throat may actually, or it often is, not a result of the virus itself affecting the throat. It's our immune system destroying the virus while also causing inflammation in our throat. So it's our body's responding to these bacteria and viruses that often make us feel sick. Another example is fevers. So when people have a fever, it's because their body detects that there's a bacteria or virus in their system and increases our body temperature, because our white blood cells work better with a higher temperature, and bacteria and viruses tend to not be able to replicate as quickly in hotter temperatures. So the antioxidant effects of elderberry help our bodies recover from being sick as well. So right now, I have a lot of patients actually who got the cold that was going around New Haven over the past 2 weeks. And they've been coming in because they feel better, but they're still coughing a lot. And it sounds like they're infected and that they could be contagious. But they don't have a fever. They feel good in terms of energy, but they have this post-infectious cough. And that post-infectious cough is part of our bodies needing, the tissues needing to heal, especially the respiratory tract needing to heal from the cold. And so I'll often recommend things like elderberry syrup or honey for people who are older than one to help heal up their respiratory tract and to help reduce that post-infectious cough. In a controlled double-blind placebo study, it was found that over a 6-day period of time in people who were infected with influenza B, there was a significant improvement in symptoms in 90% of affected individuals who took the elderberry syrup, and they found that 90% improvement within 2 days of taking the elderberry syrup. In vitro studies have shown that elderberry has some compound in it that can actually inhibit influenza type A and type B strains. So in vitro means that it's not, the tests weren't done in the body, they were done outside of the body. But that's proposed to be one of the mechanisms, is that elderberry literally has something in it that can counteract the influenza viruses. And one of the thoughts is that influenza A and B is neutralized through constituents in the elderberry binding to the hemagglutinin spikes in influenza. And the hemagglutinin spikes are the areas of the virus that land on our tissues. So I describe it as, if you picture a UFO, the landing site on a UFO, that is the hemagglutinin spikes. So it's thought that influenza A and B bind to those receptors where influenza then is unable to bind onto our tissues. And when a virus or a bacteria is unable to bind to our tissues, it's unable to infect us. It kind of just clumsily travels through our body. So elderberry syrup is one that is generally safe for all ages. You'll want to talk to your doctor specifically if you want to start taking it, but it's found to be generally safe for all ages. You can have it as juice. You can put it into a tea. You can also just have a spoonful. It's that delicious. There's also some recipes online where you can make elderberry gummies for your children. And I've done that before. That was a fun activity. So the other herb that I wanted to share with you is echinacea. It's another very popular herb in the fall months. And I'm sure that many of you have had experiences with echinacea, or as soon as you start coughing, a loved one recommends echinacea. It's specifically known for its anti-flu and anti-cold virus properties. So it stimulates the immune system and increases our macrophages, which I just described earlier were the white blood cells that go around eating bacteria and viruses and digesting them. And then it stimulates other white blood cells to respond to the infection. So the macrophages are very important. Echinacea is known to increase the macrophage activity in our lymphatic system, in our mucous membranes. So there's more macrophages, for example, in our mouth and our nose, and also on our skin. So in one study, 473 patients with early signs of influenza, half of them were given oseltamivir, which is an antiviral medication, and the other half was given an echinacea drink. And recovery from the illness was comparable in both groups, with the exception that the individuals who took echinacea had less adverse symptoms. So it was found that the antiviral medication caused more side effects than the echinacea did, and both groups recovered equally from the infection. So echinacea is definitely another herb to keep in the medicine cabinet. And that's it for our show. So thank you so much for tuning in. You are listening to Seeking Wellness Radio. I'm Dr. Verdi, and I want to wish you a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend, and tune in next month, the fourth Saturday of next month from 9 to 10 a.m. for our pre-Christmas show.
One bank. too.